I'm Lauren Layfield, and you're listening to Your Next Podcast. This is the podcast that brings you a different series every single week, helping you to find your new favourite show. So I've got something on the darker side for you this week. On a snowy night between Christmas and New Year, 1969, a woman named Muriel Mackay vanished. Her husband, Alec, came home to find her missing and quickly reported the news to the police and his colleagues at the Sun newspaper. Then the phone rang. Muriel had been kidnapped, and the people who had taken her wanted £1 million to give her back. But the really weird thing is that they were never after Muriel at all. They'd meant to kidnap the wife of Alec's boss, the newspaper billionaire Rupert Murdoch, and had made a mistake. It's a horrible but fascinating story that contains previously unbroadcast recordings of the kidnappers and such sensitive, intimate testimony from Muriel's family. The podcast is called Worse Than Murder, and it's the latest in the BBC's Intrigue series I showed you a few months ago when they did To Catch a Scorpion. Give the first episode a try. I promise you won't regret it.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
It's the 29th of December, 1969, and a Rolls-Royce is being chauffeured through light snow towards Wimbledon, southwest London. Sitting in the back is Alec Mackay, an executive at Rupert Murdoch's News Limited. Today was Alec's first day back at the office after the Christmas holidays. London's quiet. There's barely anyone else on the roads. So Alec gets home quickly. He's glad he won't be late for dinner with his wife, Muriel. At the front door, Alec rings the bell four times. Three short rings, one long. It's a secret code developed by Muriel so that she knows it's him. After a burglary a few months back, they're not taking any chances. But Muriel doesn't come to let him in. He tries again. Still, no Muriel. Alec pushes on the front door, then the inner door. To his surprise, they swing open, revealing the hallway in total disarray. A chair has been turned over. The phone has been knocked to the floor. On the bureau, there's a huge rusted knife. And there's no sign of Muriel anywhere.
Police in the London area have started a massive hunt for the wife of the deputy chairman of the News of the World.
The kidnapping of Muriel Mackay in 1969 was a story that obsessed the nation and baffled a police force. It was a completely unprecedented case, leading to the biggest manhunt of its day as the Metropolitan Police raced against the clock to find Muriel. The media were hooked. In fact, Muriel's kidnapping helped make the tabloid press into the kind of beast we know today. The story had it all. A missing wife and mother, ransom demands, police stings, possible mafia involvement, even a handful of psychics. And each new development and sensational rumour was splashed across the front pages. But the most extraordinary thing of all, this was a case of mistaken identity. It was Anna Murdoch, the wife of media titan Rupert Murdoch, that the criminals wanted to kidnap. But they took the wife of his deputy instead. My name is Jane McSorley. I've been an investigative journalist for over three decades. I've become fascinated by Muriel's disappearance, the impact it's had on her family for 55 long years, and what it tells us about the tabloid press at a defining moment in its history. To get inside the story, I've teamed up with the writer Simon Farker, who wrote a book about Muriel's case and has spent years piecing together every last scrap of evidence. For this series, we've spoken with retired cops who worked the investigation and pressmen who covered it relentlessly. We've combed through hours of archive recordings, many of which have never been made public before. And we've gotten to know Muriel's three children, now in their 80s, who've been haunted by her disappearance for over half a century. The case was officially closed in 1970, but in spite of extensive police searches at the time, Muriel's body was never found. Her family haven't been able to lay their mother to rest. But whilst we were making this series, something totally unexpected happened. New evidence from a man convicted of Muriel's murder came to light. And after tireless campaigning from her family, the Metropolitan Police agreed to do one more dig for Muriel's remains. And we've been alongside Muriel's family as they've dealt with this extraordinary turn of events. But to understand how we got here, we need to go back to where this story began, on a bitterly cold night in December 1969. From BBC Radio 4, this is Intrigue, Worse Than Murder. Episode 1, Muriel is Missing. Muriel's husband, Alec Mackay, knew something was very wrong the moment he arrived home from work, as he explained at the time.
But I rang the doorbell, as I normally would do. Nobody came. I waited for a few moments, rang it again, thinking she may be upstairs. And then I tried the door, only to find the front door open. I then saw things scattered on the floor which had come from her handbag.
Everywhere he looked, it seemed there were clues, but he couldn't quite piece them together.
The telephone had been pulled out of the wall and was off the hook. Plastic shield in the middle of the phone dial had been smashed out, and the little card that had the phone number in was missing. On the floor by the phone were a pair of Muriel's spectacles.
This is the writer Simon Farker. He's written extensively about Muriel's disappearance. We have regular calls to chat over little details of the case.
The hall chair had been knocked into the centre of the hall. On the chair there was a tangle of baling twine. To the right of the door on the bureau was this fearsome-looking rusty chopper, which he thought was a machete. It was actually a hedging billhook. It's a ferocious-looking thing, and it's huge and brutal, with a sharp, rounded end with two points on. So it was obvious straight away that someone else had been in the house, but what he didn't know at that point was whether his wife was still there.
Moving through the downstairs rooms, Alec sees that the coal fire is roaring away, unguarded. His heart sinks. It confirms what he has begun to fear.
My wife left this house against her will for, in my opinion, not only from what I saw there, but in fact she had a great fear of fire. She was meticulous that she would always put the screen in front of that fire if she was going out for any time. Now, I think no man in the world could say that his wife wouldn't leave him. I really believe that she wouldn't leave me. I'm quite sure that she wouldn't leave the dog in front of an open fire.
Alec grabs the billhook, that awful rusted knife, in case any intruders are still in the house, and runs upstairs, frantically searching for Muriel. He notices some of Muriel's jewellery has been taken, but Muriel is nowhere to be seen.
I ran from room to room calling out her name, and then I couldn't find her. I then ran around the house to garage, greenhouse.
With the phone out of operation, Alec dashes to the neighbours and dials 999. But he soon places another more surprising call as well, to Larry Lamb, the editor of the Sun newspaper. Now, if my husband were to vanish from our home without a trace, after I called the police, I think I'd be more likely to phone one of my kids than my colleagues in the BBC newsroom. But Alec really believed the press would be able to help him. He was a newspaper man through and through. His high-flying media career is the reason the Mackay family came to London in the first place. Born in Australia, he started out in the early 30s at an Adelaide daily called The News. It was part of the burgeoning media kingdom being built by Sir Keith Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch's father. As Alec climbed the ranks moving between Australia's most well-respected newspapers, his son Ian Mackay remembers the family following him around the country.
My sister Jenny was born in Adelaide. Diane was born in Melbourne. I was born in Sydney, which probably shows the progression of my father's career.
Alec's daughter Jennifer Mackay told us he was a powerhouse.
He could work the room like a queen mother. He would talk to everyone that was there, and everyone would go home with a smile on their face. And my father would do exactly the same thing. There he is, advancing all the time with a smile, a hand, and a laugh.
But Alec wasn't a journalist. He was on the commercial side of the business. And he had the unenviable job of trying to keep the newspapers in his care afloat. His daughter Diane remembers work was never far from his mind.
His career was very important to him, I would say, to the exclusion of family life. He was quite stressed out. You know, he wasn't that daddy that you might dream about.
One thing is for certain, though. Muriel, his stunning wife, was his absolute rock. In photographs their children have shown me of Muriel and Alec together, there's a tenderness and easy intimacy that just leaps out at you.
She always looked lovely, she was glamorous, she was hospitable, and she was incredibly supportive of my father. She was the best businessman's wife.
In 1951, Alec finally left Keith Murdoch's News Limited to take up a position as the advertising director of the Melbourne Argus, the first newspaper in the world to print colour photographs. But the printers were both expensive and temperamental, and by the late 50s, the paper folded.
He was the general manager in those days, so he had to sack 1,000 employees, and I always remember how it upset him.
But Alec had impressed the owners of the Argus, and so they offered him a huge opportunity in London. The advertisement director of the Daily Mirror.
The Daily Mirror, which was a high-selling tabloid in London, selling almost 5 million copies a day.
Alec seized the chance, a fresh start in one of the media capitals of the world. But his daughter Jennifer told us the kids were devastated.
I can remember seeing him off, and I have somewhere a photograph of us, my sister and I, looking like thunder. Not because he was going, but because everyone was going eventually.
Whilst her kids sulked, Muriel decided she would give them the journey of a lifetime, all paid for by Britain's most successful newspaper. It's truly a testament to Alec's esteem in the newspaper world.
We would fly to Sydney and stop there and say goodbye to all our Sydney friends. We would fly on, stopping at Fiji.
I had my birthday, which was as we crossed the international date line, so I had two birthdays. And then we took a train across the USA.
The Mackays disembarked in the city that never sleeps. Muriel had one last surprise waiting for them.
We went to My Fair Lady, which was very special.
We were lucky enough to have front row seats, and it was the original cast with Rex Harrison and Julie Andrews.
If you'd been invited to see the Queen, it couldn't have been anywhere near how important it was to see My Fair Lady.
But after a top-up lesson in English diction from Professor Henry Higgins, it was finally time to take the children to their new home. They boarded the Queen Elizabeth bound for Southampton, still, of course, first class. Alec met the family at the port, and together they drove up to London. But the dingy grey landscape was a far cry from the beautiful beaches they were used to back in Australia. And the kids felt they stuck out like sore thumbs.
Because I was Australian, every boy in the school would have to try and imitate an Australian accent.
We had neighbours at one stage. They kept saying, "You come from the Antipodes." We didn't even know what the Antipodes were. What are you talking about? You know, it was like we were some sort of people from outer space.
Whilst they missed their life in Australia, England did eventually begin to feel like a kind of home. The Mackays moved to a big, beautiful house in Wimbledon Village, near the world-famous tennis club. Before long, the kids were all grown up. They got married, moved out, and Muriel and Alec made the most of all their new home had to offer.
Well, we had Wimbledon down the road, of course, and they went to Ascot and all those sort of things. They went on holidays, you know. One of their favourite places was Mallorca. They loved Mallorca, or they also went to the Canary Islands.
I found a postcard. Here we are, yes. This is 5th of November, 1966. It says, Saturday, 2 days of sunshine spent by the pool. Had a pleasant flight, called at Madrid. Lots of ships coming in and out opposite our balcony. Love to you, Mum and Dad.
They had a wonderful time.
Muriel devoted herself to her many artistic talents. Needlework, watercolour landscapes, photography. She spent time on charity work, trying to set up a local nursery that would provide childcare for single working mothers. And Alec quickly became a force on Fleet Street. Within a year, he was appointed a director at the International Publishing Corporation, the group that owned the Daily Mirror.
In these big jobs, something that people never really consider, it's not just all about getting a job and, you know, heaps of money and whatever. I mean, you have to deliver at the end of the day, and my father was able to deliver.
But it wasn't always easy. Alec's son Ian Mackay remembers that in the early 60s, the International Publishing Corporation acquired a struggling broadsheet, the Daily Herald.
I think it needed about 2 million circulation to make it anywhere near viable. So it was losing something like £1 million a year. You might say, well, why didn't they close it down? Well, the problem was they had made an agreement that they would maintain the Daily Herald for a period of, I think it was something like 10 years.
Alec, always business-minded, spied an opening. He felt it would be better for the company as a whole to have two profitable papers instead of one.
He said, broadsheet newspapers are no longer viable. We need to relaunch the Daily Herald under a new name, and we need to relaunch it as a tabloid. The business is in tabloids. But Hugh Cudlett was totally against relaunching the Daily Herald as a tabloid.
Hugh Cudlip was the famously hard-driving editor of the Daily Mirror, credited with building its 5 million strong readership. And he didn't want any competition, especially from within the same publishing group.
Cudlip did not want anything to happen to his baby, the Mirror. It was the envy of the world.
The board sided with Hugh Cudlip. The Daily Herald would remain a broadsheet with a progressive editorial agenda, but they would give it a shiny new name, The Sun.
What's going to be the policy of The Sun during the coming general election?
Well, The Sun is a radical newspaper, so ask yourself, can a radical newspaper support the present government?
Over time, the stress of his work got to Alec.
And it was at this stage that my father actually had a coronary.
Alec tried to carry on working, but by October 1969, he needed to take a reluctant retirement. Perhaps it would be an opportunity to spend time with his grandchildren, to travel back to Australia with Muriel. But someone else had another idea.
He's chubby-cheeked and open-faced, but underneath, say those who know him, he's a man of steel. Ruthless in getting his own way, iron-willed in seeing that his plans are carried through.
Rupert Murdoch, the son of Alec's old boss back in Australia, Sir Keith Murdoch, had arrived in England to sniff out a new purchase.
Murdoch inherited the basis of his newspaper empire from his father, built on it and enlarged it to cover every state in Australia. If the News of the World deal goes through, he'll transfer his base to London.
In 1969, Murdoch beat out rival bids to take control of the News of the World before picking up The Sun for a song from Alec's old employers at the Murrow Group. His first move? Relaunching the paper as a tabloid, just like Alec had proposed.
He takes an active part in what goes into his papers, even going into the composing room to supervise what's in the page proofs for next day's edition.
Do you like the feeling of power you have as a newspaper proprietor?
Well, there's only one honest answer to that, of course, and that's yes. Of course one enjoys the feeling of power.
My father had the contacts and the confidence in London that Rupert lacked.
The way Alec's daughter Diane remembers it, Murdoch needed people around him who he could trust. And Alec was an obvious choice. He was well respected on Fleet Street, and back in Australia, Alec had been a Murdoch man. They were practically family. When Rupert Murdoch asked Alec to join him as his deputy chairman, Alec took a beat to consider. Murdoch and the Mirror were now bitter rivals, but the terms of the job were irresistible. Alec would be Rupert's right-hand man, only needed if Rupert couldn't be there himself. Alec signed just before Christmas 1969 and got started straight away. Rupert and his young wife Anna were heading back to Australia for the holidays. Alec would fill in, even getting to use the chauffeured Rolls-Royce, a perk usually reserved for the chairman. But it was that same Rolls-Royce that Alec stepped out of, just a week later, into a world he could no longer make sense of. A huge rusted knife had been left in his hallway. Items from his wife's handbag were scattered down the stairs. The fire was still roaring, and Muriel had vanished. As a Murdoch man once again, it's now easier to understand why Alec called Larry Lamb, the editor of the Sun newspaper, that night. Simon Farquhar again.
The first thing he thought was to use the tools at his disposal to try and find where his wife was. Larry Lamb, he would have been the obvious person. Who in the newspaper empire do I work for could put this story on the front pages tomorrow? The Sun was a daily, so the story could be in the following day's paper.
And does Larry Lamb then turn up? I mean, how does that all pan out?
Well, the police officers arrived first, so Inspector Anderson, the uniformed officer, arrived at the house first, surveyed the scene, sat down and talked to Mr. Mackay. And then the first CID officer arrived at the scene, Sergeant Birch. And it was just as he arrived that Larry Lamb and the photographer arrived. It would have looked very suspicious for something which ostensibly looked like a suburban burglary to suddenly have the editor of a Fleet Street newspaper on the scene straight away, and also rather presumptively arriving with a photographer.
Birch, the Criminal Investigation Department officer, refuses the photographer entry to the house. This is a potential crime scene. But as Birch recounted years later in the 2001 Anglia documentary, Manhunt, the Press Baron's Wife, produced by Ray Fitzwalter Associates, he couldn't really tell if a crime had taken place.
When I arrived, Mr. Mackay let me in and said, "My wife's gone." That's all he said at that stage. And I immediately saw on the stairs a handbag at the bottom and some ladies' items scattered up the stairs. And that struck me almost immediately like a setup for Agatha Christie play.
To D.S. Birch, things just feel off.
When you look at the crime scene photographs of that, you can understand that a little bit. The keys and so on are sort of dribbled down the stairs. They've actually been aligned, so they're in a sort of symmetrical pattern down the stairs, which looks bizarre. Muriel's handbag was moved. I think it was moved there by Larry Lamb so that he could get everything in shot, and then he went away to file his copy. They would have been very, very suspicious of that. It's also interesting that the only drawer that was disturbed was the one with the jewellery in. Normally, burglars ransack looking for something, but they knew exactly where to look here, which would suggest something that's been staged rather than something genuine.
D.S. Birch is also sceptical of Alec's calm demeanour.
You have to put yourself in Alec's situation there. All he knows is that there's been a break-in, his wife's not there, and there's some jewellery missing.
Alec can't quite work out what has happened, but Muriel is missing, and he needs the police to start taking things seriously. Furious at the suggestion that any of this could be a newspaper setup, Alec tries to reach his children, but he only gets through to his daughter Diane that evening.
I went to my father the minute he called me that night and said, "Your mother's not here." I could see the phone was on the floor, the chair was on the floor, he hadn't touched anything. There was the bill hook, and he was in a panic, and it was horrible.
The police still don't seem convinced.
They said, "Well, of course your mother's run off with a boyfriend." I said, "No, you don't know my mother. She hasn't run off with anybody." "Oh, she's gone back to Australia. She doesn't like it here." I said, "She's frequently on Australia with my father. They go every year. She has not run off to Australia. There's nothing there for her. This is her home. We are her family."
And I spoke to Sergeant Birch. His view was that it was a newspaper attempt to increase its circulation. There were newspaper men coming through the front door, speaking to the old man, poking about and disappearing again.
This is Detective Sergeant Walter White, another detective there that evening. D.S. White doesn't think much of Birch's assessment that this was a newspaper setup. He is surprised by the amount of press at the scene so early on, but he believes Alec.
I went up and I saw Alec Mackay. It looked genuine. He was a man well in control of himself, but clearly very worried.
D.S. Birch and D.S. White are the same rank. So White decides it's time to call in his superiors.
My problem was that night that I couldn't get home with Bill Smith or John Miners. And I spent most of my night trying to wring these two buggers out of their beds.
But Alec's press contacts are moving quickly. The next day's papers are already being printed. And Muriel's on almost every front page. And at 1 a.m, less than 6 hours after Alec got home, the news of her disappearance went public on BBC Radio 1.
Police in the London area have started a massive hunt for the wife of the deputy chairman of the News of the World, who was found to be missing from her house in Wimbledon this evening. The house had been ransacked and some jewellery had also been taken, although other valuables appeared untouched.
The news is even travelling down international wires. Halfway across the world, Alec and Muriel's son Ian Mackay is already in a client meeting in Sydney.
I was with this commercial artist who was laying out a book for me. And as I said, he had a little transistor radio on his desk. It was still just going in the background. We just ignored it. And then suddenly there was this news broadcast. And, I just couldn't believe it.
Ian leaves work immediately and scrambles to make arrangements to get back to his parents' house in England as soon as he possibly can. Meanwhile, back in that house, Alec and Diane are still in shock, trying to make sense of what is happening. And then the phone rings. They jump. Diane's husband picks it up. An operator asks if they'll accept a call from a phone box. As Alec is past the telephone, he hopes against hope that it's a Muriel on the other end with an explanation about what has happened. But it's a man's voice.
Is that Mr. Mackay speaking?
Alec confirms that it is.
This is Mafia Group 3. We are from America. We have your wife.
The police hadn't thought to set up a recording device. The only record of this call is a transcript D.S. White scribbled down as he listened to the call on the kitchen extension. We've got an actor to speak them, but the words, they're real.
We have your wife. It will cost you £1 million to get her back.
Alec protests. He doesn't have £1 million, nowhere near it. It's an impossible amount of money, almost 14 million today, but the caller doesn't care.
You'd better get it. Your friends get it from them. Get £1 million by Wednesday or you're going to have a serious problem.
And he says something even more shocking too. Muriel wasn't even his intended target.
We tried to get Rupert Murdoch's wife. We couldn't get her, so we took yours instead. I haven't much time, so don't waste it. You have £1 million by Wednesday night or we will kill her. Do you understand? All you have to do is wait for a contact. We will contact you on Wednesday. Get the money or you won't have a wife.
The line goes dead, and Alec is stunned. Is this caller for real? And if so, where on earth is he going to get £1 million? Next time, on Worse Than Murder.
Where do you get £1 million from? I wouldn't know.
Well, I don't know. That's my business.
Well, if you want it, it's your business, isn't it?
There's nobody profited, and a lot of people lost. I think it's the most hideous crime that can perpetrate against anyone. Kidnapping? It's worse than just a straight murder.
Worse Than Murder is hosted by me, Jane McSorley, with Simon Farker. It is produced by Nadia Mady. Extra production by Paul Russell. The story editor is Andrew Dixon, with sound design by Basil Oxtoby. It is a Fresh Air and Telltale production for BBC Radio 4.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
For years, a witness's evidence has been locked away.
I've seen the dark side.
He warned a chemical is coming.
It's a silent killer.
And that he was a target.
Forced into a witness protection program.
We're Dan Ashby and Lucy Taylor, two investigative journalists, joined by the Hollywood star, Michael Sheen.
Do you think someone's going to try and kill us?
From BBC Radio 4, an unsettling investigation into a chemical secret unravels.
They don't have any record of him.
What?
Listen now to Bury the Last Witness on BBC Sounds.
Wow, it's just unbelievable, isn't it? You can go and hear the rest of the story right now by searching for Intrigue in your podcast app. Just before you do, though, remember to tap follow here. I've got so many great podcasts coming up to introduce you to, and I don't want you to miss a thing. And you can find all my recommendations, along with news, reviews, and so much more on Podcast Rex at www.podcastrex.com. That's www.podcastrex.com.